May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other.
Good morning, everybody. I've never spoken in front of a large group of people, so this is first time. My name is Rima. I go to this church. I found the church because 1 year ago you used to have the service in the night, and it was advertised in one of the papers, and I came, and I liked it because the people were respectful of all the people's religion. I come from Suriname. I'm part Indian and part Indonesian, and we are Hindu, but we do respect all religions. Today I want to tell you a little bit about Diwali. Diwali is the Hindu festival of light. The celebration is in honor of the return of Rama and Sita to the kingdom after 14 years of exile. It's a celebration of darkness over light. So in the homes, people put the diyas. They're like candles made out of clay all around the home to welcome her. And also marks the beginning of the new year. And people like to pay off their debts if possible. And also they get new clothes and gifts, and they're supposed to clean their houses. And outside they make these beautiful patterns they call it rangoli, sometimes with flour or crushed rice powder with coloring. Also, people visit other people's home and have parties and give sweets and candies, and like we have today. So it's a time of fun, and it's a new beginning. So to everybody, Shubh Diwali, and thank you for this is a really nice church, and we enjoy coming to it, and thank you again.
I've celebrated Diwali in many ways and many places throughout my life. As a kid, growing up in Canada, there were always sort of Indian Diwali house parties, for example, where the local Indian community in our little town in Canada would get together, and, you know, we would do a little puja, which is a worship ceremony. You'll find out more about that. And we would do all the rituals, and we just have fun. And we celebrate the renewal of what we consider the new year. I mean, we also celebrate New Year's as well, because, you know, we're in North America, so we're wise to all the ways. And also, every year there would also be a massive puja in Toronto, which is the big city in Toronto, in Canada. And, I mean, hundreds upon thousands of Indians would gather at some rented high school auditorium, and there were several of these all over the city, these big celebrations. And, you know, you see all the signs, there's the incense burning, there's large deities and blessings and offerings, live music, dance and theater, and it's all very beautiful and elaborate. It was a lot of fun, and we got to see all our old, you know, all the Indian friends who live in all different parts, and we all got to know each other that way. It was a really wonderful thing. It's very much like Christmas, and in that way. It's a time of renewal. The things that we would do... you know, we would pray for a good following year. We would listen to all our ancient stories and sing ancient verses and meet with family and friends. And my family, we celebrated basically 4 days. But there are, you know, you can go weeks on Diwali. Some people start 2 weeks early. And just like Christmas, they start the day after Halloween here, I think. So one of the things we do, for example, like all men or all boys have to buy a present for their female cousins or sisters. It's sort of a sister's day. And, you know, as Vicky will mention, is that one of the big things in Diwali is that we're worshiping the divine goddess Lakshmi. Lakshmi is called the goddess of wealth, but when what we refer to in wealth in the spiritual sense is much more than material being happiness. It's more like sustain us and give us more, you know, and for ourselves, to make ourselves better, to enrich ourselves. And you know, and if you give give presents to your sisters and your female cousins, it's one way to keep the goddess happy, you know. it's one thing that sometimes gets forgotten in Hinduism, but it's an absolute truth in all the Vedas, all written down, is that female energy is extremely important, that there is no universe without female energy and male energy together. And as a child, of course, I visited India every few years, and a few times I got to experience Diwali in India, and woo, boy, that was crazy. It was like fireworks everywhere. Enormous processions. It's just like, it's mind-blowing how big it is. I mean, it's just a, you know, I'm sure most of these fireworks would be illegal here. you know, when I got older, when I was a teenager, and I was like, kind of had a disaffection for religious ritual after a while. And, but I, you know, even then I can't ignore it. I have to, you know, I have to go along with it. So here's Diwali. We got some friends over, you know, I'm reading a book or reading the paper, maybe watching TV. And it's like, yeah, whatever, you know. And my mom comes in with her tray and it's like, okay, we got to stop what we're doing. And then she would have us hold a betel nut, and then she'd have the deity and a candle and some incense, and she would put the circle around us, and she would put rice in our hair and then put this red paste right down what some call the third eye. It's the devotional chakra. If you study yoga, there's a chakra here, and you know, and then she would chant a little mantra, and then move on to my brother, and then my sister, and then my father. As soon as she was done, my brother, sister, and I ran to the bathrooms and washed everything off. So that's a little slice of life of my relationship with Diwali, and more on that later. Thank you.
Well, now I thought I would tell you a little bit, and we'd meet these deities who are represented here on these batiks and cloth and paper. First is Ganesh. Ganesh is the elephant-headed god. He is the son of the god Shiva and the goddess Parvati. As you can see, he's usually depicted as quite rotund, pot-bellied. He often has a mouse vehicle. Here he's riding on several. He is referred to as the single-tusked. And there's many stories about how Ganesh got an elephant head and how he lost a tusk. But I'm not going to tell you those this morning because we're sticking to Diwali. But Ganesh has a special status in the pantheon of Hindu deities, as he is always the first one worshipped at any time. In a temple, he'll always be right near the entrance. And it is appropriate because Ganesh is understood as the remover of obstacles, so that if you're coming to worship, you would pray first to Ganesh, and if there was anything in your life or in your heart that was going to hinder your worship, then Ganesh would do his work and make it open, open your heart, open your mind, so that you will be able to enter into the worship. Ganesh is worshipped also at the openings of stores, at the beginnings of studies, when a business opens their books for a new year. Blessings are sought for the beginning of any sort of project or endeavor to remove obstacles and to allow prosperity and the endeavor to be prosperous. Now, then we're going to move along to, beside Ganesh, is Lakshmi. Lakshmi is the goddess of prosperity and wealth. She is the main consort of the god Vishnu. We would, in a puja, the goddess is always worshipped before gods. And she is considered the embodiment of loveliness, grace, and charm. She is always depicted either seated or standing on a lotus flower, and this lovely, and with gold coins issuing forth from her hands, pouring down. She is, the lotus flower is quite a lovely metaphor for life. It's the sort of beautiful, exotic blossom that comes out of the depths, the murky depths where there's all sorts of slimy dirt. So we should not be surprised when life unexpectedly produces great beauty. In fact, we should always have our eyes open for that. It's a gift. Now, Lakshmi is the goddess of prosperity, but these are the words of Muniji, a teacher who's in the Himalayas, who's been a good teacher to Atul. He says that in its highest meaning, Lakshmi provides wealth for sustenance, not for indulgence. Our material wealth and prosperity should only sustain us, giving us that which is necessary to preserve our lives. She does not give wealth so that we may become fat and lazy. That is what we tend to do with the wealth we receive. Let us remember, then, that Lakshmi's material wealth is meant for sustenance and preservation, not for luxury or decadence. So skipping over to the far image of, this is Lord Krishna. Krishna is an avatar of Vishnu. Now, an avatar is an incarnation or descent of a god or goddess onto earth. Krishna has more avatars, I think, than anyone. He's come as a tortoise in different forms, but when Vishnu comes as Krishna, he's human. He's in fact born and is raised in a village. He's a cowherd, and he has many friends that are cowherds as well, and he is very charming, especially when he plays his flute, and all the milkmaids love him. So he's a very well-loved god, and he is thought of in many, many different ways by Indians. He's seen as a naughty boy, and there are many stories about Krishna when he was a baby, and many people have figures of the baby Krishna. He's also a romantic lover, a heroic warrior, a shrewd diplomat, and a great ascetic, the fullest and most perfect expression of the divine, many consider him. Now, Diwali is a celebration of Krishna's victory over a terrible demon named Narakasura, who had won boons and was very, very powerful. And so this powerful demon was terrorizing both humans and celestial beings. And so the gods called on Krishna to intervene and get rid of this demon somehow. And it wasn't easy to do because one of the boons this demon had won was that he could not be killed by anyone except his mother. So it's very fortunate that Krishna happened to have a consort who was his mother. And she was the one who got him with her arrow. So there was a great victory won over evil and darkness in this heroic act of rescue. Also, I just wanted to mention that Krishna is also the charioteer in the Bhagavad Gita, and there's the connection with the transcendentalists, especially Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson, for whom this was a very important piece of religious text. Krishna comes and is the charioteer for this hesitant warrior going into battle who doesn't want to fight his relatives. And the god reframes it, gives him a teaching about dharma and your place in the grand scheme of things. And so that's all I'll say about that. But the main story that is told at Diwali is one I'm going to allow Atul, my husband, to explain to you. He's been studying it for a few years as he's worked on a television show for international audiences. And this is about Rama, Sita, Lakshman, and Hanuman.
So the story, Ramayana, or Ramayana, however you want to pronounce it, it's a big part of Diwali. It's not the only part of Diwali, but it's important. My mother's house in Kolhapur, which is the town where she's from, there's a temple that's about 1,200 years old. It's still being used. It's still there. And every year in Diwali, there's a guy sits underneath this enormous, I don't know how old this banyan tree is, hundreds of years old, sits underneath there and tells this story over a period of many days. The Ramayana was written down about 2,400 years ago by a sage named Valmiki. It's been added on to, it's been changed since then. You know, people have added things just like they did to Shakespeare. But the essential story is pretty much the same wherever you get the translation. And it's told in pretty much every country in Asia, believe it or not, including China. The Legend of the Monkey King includes the Ramayana as one of the parts of the story. And what we do every year is that we have to remind ourselves how Diwali relates to this epic. And this epic is important in Hinduism because it actually united so many different parts of Hinduism. Because so many gods are involved in the story. Suddenly they just, it's like a movie with a whole bunch of stars in it, you know, an all-star cast, and everybody goes, wow, you know, hey, there's my god, you know. And it was a big deal. And again, it's been told for thousands of years. And before it was written down, it was believed there was an oral tradition that went on untold centuries before that. So nobody really knows how old the story is and what some of the truths are of it. There are many theories and many scholars talking about it. Now, one scholar, for example, takes the dates, just like I think a saint did this with the Bible, and places it back 10,000 years ago. And Hindus say, oh, 100,000 years ago. So whenever it was before recorded history that we know of. So it's a huge story, so I'm just going to really give you very basics. I'm going to run through the characters very quickly and just let you know how this relates to us. Now, Vicky mentioned Vishnu. Vishnu, he comes down to earth. He incarnates every time we need some help. He's a protector. He protects the people who stand for truth. And the difference between when he comes down as Rama and Krishna, see, when he comes down as Krishna, he knows he's Vishnu, right? And he came down for a human experience. It's like, oh, yeah, I can hang out with the milkmaids and play the flute, woohoo! You know, and he really got to know what it's like to be human, and he mingled with us. Whereas when he came down as Rama, he had no idea he was Vishnu. He just thought he was human. He just thought he was a guy. He had amazing powers, and everybody loved him for he didn't know why. And he had this amazing aura, and he just well, I guess I'm lucky, you know. And his brother Lakshman had a little tiny divine spark, and he would be with him forever. And then his wife Sita is the incarnation of Mahalakshmi, who you see right beside. The orange picture. The orange picture depicts our four characters in the Ramayana. And see, whenever Vishnu comes to Earth, his wife's got to come, you know, so they got to be together. It's very important. And again, it ties into the male and female energies of the universe being together. Hanuman, it's a guy I may not be able to see him, but he's kneeling down. He's got a monkey-like face. Now, he's my personal favorite, but not just mine, but many around India love this guy. I mean, he's such a character. He's actually stronger and mightier than Rama. He has a complete mastery of all the known texts of the day. He was a scholar, a physicist, everything, and a very great poet and linguist. But he was a monkey, and he lived among a tribe of these monkey-like people who were basically ascetics. And some of them, you know, they all had human. Some had human traits as well. Like their king. So Hanuman is the ultimate servant. I mean, with all these great powers and all these great abilities, he bows down before Ram because he sees that he's Vishnu. Ram himself doesn't know it. He's like, oh, God, this guy's a nice guy to me, isn't he? But Hanuman could see the divine spark and would serve him and use everything in his power to help him. When this came into play, I should mention the basic story is a triumph of good over evil. Unlike other times in our history, good and evil was reasonably well defined in this book. Good is spiritual power, the greater good for all humans and creatures to surrender to your higher duty and to selfless sacrifice. Higher duty also means sacred duty, which also is the word dharma. Dharma is an important word in Hinduism, very central word. And that has to triumph over self-interest, over the acquisition of material power for greed, the law of the jungle, no duty to anyone but me. That's the evil. They enhance that a little bit and say they're demons with horrible teeth and they'll eat you and stuff, right? Just to really play it up a little more. So what happens is that there's this king, this demon king, Ravana, this ten-headed guy, ten heads, absolutely the most powerful being in the known universe. At this time in our history, according to this epic, the world was not run by humans. Humans were a lesser species. There was a higher species, a more powerful species, called the Rakshasas. And they would travel to different planets and bring their wealth back to this planet. By the way, thousands of years ago, we had stories about science fiction with interplanetary travel and spaceships and the whole thing. And weapons of mass destruction as well. We had that in our stories. So these guys, they were feared, and they were just, leave them alone. We'll have our little kingdoms, and hopefully they don't bother us, you know. And they were absolutely ruthless and terrible as time went on. But they were actually very sophisticated and highly intelligent. They're not just like, you know, monsters. They were interesting people. In fact, this demon king is often worshipped as a god. So, but what separated him, a demon from a god, is that the demon does not work towards the greater good. Now, what this demon king did, he saw Sita being the perfect woman. She's the incarnation of a goddess. He took his flying machine, his spaceship, tricked Rama and kidnapped her and took her away. And Rama, I mean, he's as human as anyone because that's what he came down as, was completely broken apart. Now, this is the male and female energies of the universe have now been separated. It's now time for God to take action. And he did. In the prophecy, the demon king, when he first got all his amazing powers, he was told, you cannot be killed by a god or a demon. So that's why Vishnu came down as Rama, because, and not knowing that he was a god, because only a human or a monkey could kill him. That brings us to Rama and Hanuman as our heroes. Now, I'm going to skip over a huge portion of the, you know, about 700 pages. I'm going to skip past that and say, they won the war. It was a horrible, awful thing. They were up against weapons of mass destruction. They were up against these amazing weapons that you just can't believe that's described, sound weapons, laser weapons using solar rays, all these amazing things. And all they had was a bunch of monkeys with clubs, and they had yogic powers in which they can end herbal cures to keep renewing themselves, as Vicky had mentioned when Hanuman cured the entire army. And in the end, they crowned a new king of Lanka, and this king was a benevolent king and said, you know what? That flying machine that we stole Sita from, you can go back in that. Take Sita with you and take that flying machine. It's like, wow, cool. And so they get up and all the monkey army get in this machine and they fly over India. Now, all of India have known about this battle. They know who Rama is now. And they know what he stands for, that he stands for the greater good, that he is not, he's selfless. He just spent 14 years living in the woods eating berries, right? And he's a king. He's royal blood. So they all love him. And this is how Diwali comes in. And you put your lamp outside your door so that, because he's driving the spaceship, he doesn't know how to navigate it. I mean, he's a guy living in the woods and he's riding the spaceship. So he looks down, he can see all the lights leading him back to his kingdom. And the light is an important symbol, as it is in Unitarian Universalism. It represents the soul. And even though we say good and evil actions are only reflections of our relationship with our soul, according to our Hindu beliefs. So when you light that candle, or you light that oil lamp, you're saying, I'm in touch with my soul, I believe in the greater, in acting towards the greater good, I'm in sync with you, Rama, as you fly over, let me help you find your way so you can be crowned king, and order is restored, and we're all going to celebrate. And that's it. It's that they are in sync with the reunion of the male and female energies of universal truth. And that's basically it. Thank you.
Before we sing the children out to their RE classes, I just wanted to show and point out the elements of the puja worship ceremony. We aren't doing a puja, but there are many elements here that are typical of the basic worship ceremony done all over the place in India, wherever there's an altar and a deity. Flowers are presented as an offering. If they're not often they're in garlanded like this. Often they're petals and they're thrown at the deity. Fruit is often given to nourish and please the deity. Sweets are given at Diwali time as a special holiday treat. Light is a very important part, especially at Diwali, and there's also a vessel of water, and water would also be part of it. With the light is a custom called arti, and I'll just demonstrate it very, very quickly. Circled around each deity, starting with Ganesh, Lakshmi, Ram, Sita, Hanuman, Lakshman, and Krishna. And then what happens, all these offerings are shared with all the worshippers. So Atul is going to help me show how the light is shared with someone who's worshipping. And the priest will go and give everyone a chance to share in the worship. Sprinkle water. Afterwards, these sweets the sweets and the food is offered to everyone at the conclusion of the ceremony, as it will be today when you go out for coffee. Have a coconut burfi, handmade here in town, and there's 10 pounds of it, so there should be enough. Let's sing the children out. This is the center of our service, or a little bit past. And it's a time for you to participate by lighting a candle, a votive candle, to mark a prayer, a hope, a sorrow, whatever you will. It's especially appropriate on Diwali to light a candle. So this is the time if you would like to come forward and light a candle.
This is a prayer called the Gayatri Mantra, and I'm going to give you the English translation. O God, Thou art the giver of life, the remover of pain and sorrow, the bestower of happiness. O Creator of the universe, may we receive your supreme sin-destroying light. May you guide our intellect in the right direction.
As you may already know, I lived in India for a year and 9 months before coming to Austin. We lived in the extreme south of the subcontinent on the western shores in a small state called Kerala. It's semi-tropical and it's a coastline state onto the Arabian Sea. Very, very verdant. Coconut trees everywhere. It's a beautiful, hot, humid place to be. One of the densest populations in India is in Kerala. This sari that I'm wearing today is typical of its traditional wear for the women, this unbleached, very fine cotton thread with the gold threads woven through. And this one was given to me by friends in Kerala, and it has a motif of the lotus again. So today I wanted to talk about how we recognize God. I was very happy that I was invited by one of the book discussion groups in the last little while to visit with them as they read a book by Diana Eck, who is a professor of comparative religion at Harvard University. And this is a book called Encountering God, which I highly recommend. It talks about her experience of pluralism. That is, this experience of recognizing the legitimacy, the validity, God in the ways of another people or in the ways of another religion. She was studying pilgrimage when she went to the place where we lived in India, a city called Trivandrum or Tiruvananthapuram. And there is a major temple there, very, very old, and it is called Padmanabha Swami Temple. And I couldn't pronounce it at all the whole time I was there. She had this experience here that she writes about, and I wanted to share it with you this morning. She was saying, but to as a preface to that, she's asserting that recognizing God is not an easy task. It is not the simple affirmation that all these visions of God are the same. They are not. And she admits, as a Christian, there are lots of places where she doesn't recognize God. But what I'm going to read you now is the time when she visited this temple and was there for the puja ceremony in front of, in the inner sanctum where the main deity is installed. And that main deity is an 18-foot long statue of Vishnu sleeping, reclining on a multi-headed snake. And it's there's three doorways that open up to different parts of this 18-foot long deity. So these are her words when she was there. I lined up with the other woman at the north door of the central shrine as the time approached for the aarti, where the lamps, the light is offered, the evening offering of oil lamps. The drums began to beat and the bells clang. The reedy nadaswaram, which is an instrument, so typical of South Indian temples, began to whine. The attendant drew back the bar and we all seemed to move en masse, propelled by the surge of a wave of bodies into the inner sanctum. As the bells rang with an increasing sense of crescendo, suddenly the central pair of doors to Vishnu's chamber were flung open to reveal part of the huge reclining image. Then the pair of doors to the left were flung open, revealing the upper portion of Vishnu. And then the doors to the right revealing his feet. I could not see the image very well at all, but as the many different multi-wicked lamps of aarti were waved to honor Vishnu, I could see the suggestion of his presence there. It was a sense of enormous presence, dimly seen, illumined for a moment with oil lamps by the intermediary grace of the priest, who moved the soft light before the long body of the Lord. She goes on to say, seeing this triptych in the temple, with its three glimpses of a God larger than one could fully comprehend, was a moment of recognition for me, and the experience of God's presence there was describable only as worship. My experience as a Christian was surely different from that of the Hindus pressed against me on either side. But we shared the sense of delight and revelation as the doors were opened, and perhaps some sense of the majesty and mystery of the divine. When I was in India and visiting many beautiful temples, I learned that my own way of worship is quite Western. I have a strong preference for coming into a place where order prevails, where I get to choose a seat and I can sit still and I can have some privacy in that sitting still, and that I can have this privacy to pray or worship in the way that I need to. And I can be happy because I have friends and familiar faces around me. And they're doing the same thing, too. At least I'm pretty sure they are. Now, so I had a hard time settling down when I went to visit temples, and worship was very difficult for me to settle into. But I still loved observing it, and it's a very beautiful thing, as you can see. There's much to please not just the gods. Now, this morning you've seen pictures of deities and all these elements of the puja. You've had sort of a smorgasbord or a sampler of Hindu worship. And I just wanted to address the question you might be sitting on, which is why? How does foreign festival follow fascism? Who was here last week and heard Davidson preach on fascism? A lot of people. So last week your minister had a very heavy prophetic message for all of us. The times do seem bleak. This time after the election has half the country ebullient and half the country quite depressed. I've heard people talk about feeling hatred when they see bumper stickers for the other guys. And there's a sense of worry and wonder how it's going to be in another 4 years. Now, Veterans Day was also difficult. My son's school had a whole week of celebration, and it was a glorification of war. My son and all the kids in that school listened as the principal said, you know, asserted that these all the armed service people were over fighting for their freedom. And I hope, for the sake of all the people who have died, Iraqis and Americans and other folks, I hope that there is some element of truth in that. But the heaviness is real and the gloom is felt. So why are we celebrating Diwali? Diwali is a New Year's celebration. It's a new year based on a different calendar, a lunar calendar, an ancient Indian calendar that's still in use for worship. But we know about celebrating New Year's, and maybe we need to be reminded of it. New Year's, it's about hope. It's about letting go of those things that you need to let go of from the last period of time and starting over. Celebrating with raised spirits, or celebrating because you need to raise your spirits. Right now, I think we all need some of that. Diwali is about light, candlelight, lamplight, the lights we put out to guide our loved ones home, the light we put out to give cheer. We know about this too. It's Christmas lights, and especially when they were just a once in the year kind of thing. They raise our spirits. Diwali is also about light and dark and about the celebration of light overcoming darkness. And I think we could use some stories about how that happens. In fact, we should all collect them and tell them to each other whenever we meet, as sisters and brothers of this church. The story of Rama and Sita, as it is told in the Ramayana, is the story of good overcoming evil. But it is also a story that's filled with tragedy. So even as we celebrate the light, let us not forget that tragedy is part of life, and let's not be too afraid of it. In the Ramayana, Rama slays this terrible and powerful demon who has robbed the world and beyond of all the riches and has enslaved thousands, countless people. The demon has also kidnapped Rama's wife Sita, and so Rama is coming up against a very formidable foe. He's terrifying and powerful, much more powerful. And Rama only has a broken heart because he's missing his wife, worried about her. He has righteousness. And he also has some very, very loyal friends. Fine possessions, really. His army is almost dead in the battles, but as it ends up, Rama's arrow kills the terrible demon and rescues the whole world from the darkness and enslavement, which were mere reflections of this demon's reign. It all disappeared. Now, isn't that a good story for us right now? It is a good story and has been a good story for humans to hear all the time, and that's why it's been told since the 4th century BC at least. All over India, in every conceivable form of art. Rama is the model being. He is dutiful to his parents, devoted to his brother, in love with his wife. He is not a fearless leader, but he is a true leader. That is, he has the love and the trust of his followers. Don't we need such a vision of leadership to capture the popular imagination of this world, this nation? It is not our story, but it is a good story, and maybe we could find some sustenance in it. Finally, when I was in India, there was one small religious ritual that would always touch me very deeply every time I saw it. We had a whole series of drivers when we were living there, and they were all Hindu, and they were all natives of Kerala. Some of them would have little deities on the dashboards and sandalwood paste and flowers. And on many days, they would show the sign that they had been to the temple with sandalwood paste on their forehead or neck. And the thing that would always touch me, though, was when they were driving, if they would go by a temple, no matter how big or small, and some of them are very small roadside ones, they would always keep what they're doing, watch the road, keep in conversation, but they would always touch their heart. They would very lightly take their hand and touch the tips of their fingers to their chest. And this moved me because what I saw was that there was always a part of their consciousness that stayed steadily on God and remained with her, or remembered to return to her. And that was more impressive to me than almost anything else, just that little gesture, private gesture that connects each person to the source of all creation. Whenever we remember that we are connected to all living creation, we are. There is no physical change caused by this remembering. There is no metaphysical change. It is just a realization that can reorient us. And we must remember to remember that we are connected constantly. Prayer without ceasing.